strong and proud. "This is not the Stone Age," I said, "but it feels like we are going backward. Girls are getting more deprived of our rights." I spoke about how much I loved school, about how important it was to keep learning. "We are afraid of no one, and we will continue our education. This is our dream." And I knew in that instant that it wasn't me, Malala, speaking. My voice was the voice of so many others who wanted to speak but couldn't. Microphones made me feel as if I was speaking to the whole world. I had talked to only local TV stations and newspapers, but still, I felt as if the wind would carry my words, the same way it scatters flower pollen in the spring, planting seeds all over the earth. And I had started a funny habit. I sometimes found myself looking in the mirror and giving speeches. Our house was often full of relatives from Shangla who came to Mingora when they needed to go to the doctor or do some shopping. The kitchen was full of aunties gossiping. The guest room was full of uncles arguing, and the house was full of little children playing and crying and arguing. With all this chaos swirling about, I would escape into the bathroom and look in the mirror. When I looked in the mirror, though, I didn't see myself. I saw hundreds of people listening to me. My mother's voice would snap me out of my daydream. "Pisho," she'd say, "what are you doing in there? Our guests need to use the bathroom." I felt quite silly sometimes when I realized I was giving a speech to a mirror in the toilet. "Malala," I would say to myself, "what are you doing?" Maybe, I thought, I was still that little Malala who lectured an empty classroom. But maybe it was something more. Maybe that girl in the mirror, that girl who imagined speaking to the world, was the Malala I would become. So throughout 2008, as our SWAD was being attacked, I didn't stay silent. I spoke to local and national TV channels, radio, and newspapers. I spoke out to anyone who would listen. Chapter 12, A Schoolgirl's Diary. After the 15th of January, no girl, whether big or little, shall go to school. Otherwise, you know what we can do, and the parents and the school principal will be responsible. That was the news that came over Radio Mulla in late December 2008. At first, I thought it was just one of his crazy pronouncements. It was the 21st century. How could one man stop more than 50,000 girls from going to school? I am a hopeful person. My friends may say too hopeful, maybe even a little crazy. But I simply did not believe that this man could stop us. School was our right. We debated his edict in class. "Who will stop him?" the other girl said. "The Taliban have already blown up hundreds of schools, and no one has done anything." "We will," I said. "We will call on our government to come and end this madness." "The government," one girl said. "The government can't even shut down Fazlullah's radio station." The debate went round and round. I didn't give in. But even to me, my argument sounded a bit thin. One by one, girls stopped coming to school. Their fathers forbade them. Their brothers forbade them. Within days, we had gone from 27 girls in our grade to 10. I was sad and frustrated. But I also understood. In our culture, girls do not defy the males in their families. And I realized that the fathers and brothers and uncles who made my friends stay home were doing so out of concern for their safety. It was hard not to feel a bit depressed sometimes, not to feel as though the families who kept their girls at home were simply surrendering to Fazlullah. But whenever I'd catch myself giving in to a feeling of defeat, I'd have one of my talks with God. "Help us appreciate the school days that are left to us, God, and give us the courage to fight even harder for more." School had been due to end the first week of January for our usual winter break, so my father decided to postpone the holiday. We would remain in classes through January 14. That way we could squeeze in every minute left to us. And the 10 remaining girls in my class lingered in the courtyard every day after school in case these were our last chances to be together. At home in the evenings, I wondered what I would do with my life if I couldn't go to school. One of the girls at school had gotten married off before Fazlullah's edict. She was 12. I knew my parents wouldn't do that to me, but I wondered, what would I do? Spend the rest of my life indoors, out of sight, with no TV to watch and no books to read? How would I complete my studies and become a doctor, which was my greatest hope at the time? I played with my shoebox dolls and thought, the Taliban want to turn the girls of Pakistan into identical lifeless dolls. While we girls savored the days until January 15, Fazlullah struck again and again. The previous year had been hard, but the days of January 2009 were among the darkest of our lives. Every morning, someone arrived at school with a story about another killing, sometimes two, sometimes three a night. Fazlullah's men killed a woman in Mingora because they said she was doing fahashi, or being indecent, because she was a dancer. And they killed a man in the valley because he refused to wear his pants short the way the Taliban did. And now, we would be forbidden from going to school. One afternoon, I heard my father on the phone. All the teachers have refused, he said. They are too afraid. But I will see what I can do. He hung up and rushed out of the house. A friend who worked at the BBC, the powerful British Broadcasting Corporation network, had asked him to find someone from the school to write a diary about life under the Taliban for its Urdu website, a teacher or an older student. All the teachers had said no, but Mariam's younger sister, Aisha, one of the older girls, had agreed. The next day, we had a visitor, Aisha's father. He would not allow his daughter to tell her story. It's too risky, he said. My father didn't argue with him. The Taliban were cruel, but even they wouldn't hurt a child, he wanted to say. But he respected Aisha's father's decision and prepared to call the BBC with the bad news. I was only 11, but I said, why not me? I knew he'd wanted someone older, not a child. I looked at my father's hopeful, nervous face. He had been so brave for speaking out. It was one thing to talk to national and local media, but this diary might be read by people outside Pakistan. It was the BBC, after all. My father had always stood by me. Could I stand by him? I knew without even thinking that I could. I would do anything to be able to continue going to school. But first, we went to my mother. If she was afraid, I wouldn't do it. Because if I didn't have her support, it would be like speaking with only half my heart. But my mother agreed. She gave us her answer with a verse from the Holy Quran. Falsehood has to die, she said, and truth has to come forward. God would protect me, she said, because my mission was a good one. Many people in Swat saw danger everywhere they looked. But our family didn't look at life that way. We saw possibility. And we felt a responsibility to stand up for our homeland. My father and I are the starry-eyed ones. Things have to get better, we always say. My mother is our rock. While our heads are in the sky, her feet are on the ground. But we all believed in hope. Speaking up is the only way things will get better, she said. I had never written a diary before and didn't know how to begin, so the BBC correspondent said he would help me. He had to call me on my mother's phone because, even though we had a computer, there were frequent power cuts and few places in Mingora with internet access. The first time he called, he told me he was using his wife's phone because his own phone had been bugged by the intelligence services. He suggested that I use a fake name so the Taliban wouldn't know who was writing the diary. I didn't want to change my name, but he was worried about my safety. That is why he chose a pseudonym for me, Gulmakai, which means cornflower, and is the name of a heroine in the Pashtun folk story. My first diary entry appeared on January 3, 2009, about 2 weeks before Fazlullah's deadline. The title was, I Am Afraid. I wrote about how hard it was to study or to sleep at night with the constant sounds of fighting in the hills outside town. And I described how I walked to school each morning looking over my shoulder for fear I'd see a Talib following me. I was writing from the privacy of my bedroom, using a secret identity, but thanks to the internet, the story of what was happening in Swat was there for the whole world to see. It was as if God had at long last granted my wish for that magic pencil. In my next entry, I wrote about how school was the center of my life and about how proud I was to walk the streets of Mingora in my school uniform. As exciting as it was to be Gulmakai, it was hard not to tell anyone, especially at school. The diary of this anonymous Pakistani schoolgirl was all anyone talked about. One girl even printed it out and showed it to my father. It's very good, he said, with a knowing smile. With the threat of school closing quickly becoming a reality, I appreciated going even more. In the days leading up to the last one, it was decided that wearing our uniforms was too dangerous, so we were told to dress in our everyday clothes. I decided I wasn't going to cower in fear of Fazlullah's wrath. I would obey the instruction about the uniform, but that day I chose my brightest pink shalwar kameez. As soon as I left the house, I thought for a second about turning back. We'd heard stories of people throwing acid in the faces of girls in Afghanistan. It hadn't happened here yet, but with everything that had happened, it didn't seem impossible. But somehow, my feet carried me forward, all the way to school. What a peculiar place Mingora had become. Gunfire and cannons as background noise. Hardly any people in the streets. And if you did see anyone, you couldn't help but think, this person could be a terrorist. And a girl, in a pink shalwar kameez, sneaking off to school. The BBC correspondent asked for more news from Swat for the next diary post. I didn't know what to tell him. He asked me to write about the killings. It seemed so obvious to him that this was news. But to me, what you experience every day is no longer news. It was as if I had become immune to fear. Until one day, on my way home from school, I heard a man behind me say, I will kill you. My heart stopped, but somehow my feet kept going. I quickened my pace until I was far ahead of him. I ran home, shut the door, and after a few seconds, peeked out at him. There he was, oblivious to me, shouting at someone on his phone. I laughed a bit at myself. Malala, I told myself, there are real things to be afraid of. You don't need to imagine danger where there is none. The real worry, it seemed to me, was being found out. And of course, it was Moniba, who was first to guess the identity of Gulmakai. I read a diary in the newspaper, she told me one day at recess, and the story sounded like our story, what happens in our school. It's you, isn't it? She said. I could not lie, not to Moniba. But when I confessed, she became more angry than ever. How can you say you're my best friend when you're keeping such an important secret from me? She turned on her heel and left. And yet I knew, as angry as she was, she wouldn't reveal my secret. It was my father who did that. By accident, of course. He was telling a reporter how terrifying it was for children just to walk to and from school. His own daughter, he said, thought a man on his phone had threatened to kill her. Just about everyone recognized the story from the diary, and by April, my days as Gulmakai, the secret diarist, would be over. But the diary had done its job. Now a number of reporters were following the story of Fazlullah's attempt to shut down the girls' schools of Pakistan, including a man from the New York Times. Chapter 13. Class Dismissed. Ever since I'd started doing interviews, people in Mingora sometimes came up to me and told me I had done well. But many of my mother's friends were scandalized that I had shown my face on TV. Some even said that she would go to hell for not raising me better. And although my mother never said anything to me, I know that she would probably have preferred that I had worn a veil. But even if my mother disagreed with my choice, and even if her friends criticized her, she stood behind me. Meanwhile, even some of my friends asked why I let the world see my face. Fazlullah's men wear masks, I said, because they are criminals. But I have nothing to hide, and I have done nothing wrong. I'm proud to be a voice speaking out for girls' education, and proud to show my identity. A madman was about to kick more than 50,000 girls out of school in a matter of days, and all people seemed to want to talk about was whether I should have worn a veil. Meanwhile, my brother Khushal was saying that for once he wished he were a girl so he didn't have to go to school. I wondered sometimes if the world had turned upside down. My mother and father liked to watch my interviews, but I usually ran out of the room when they came on the TV. I always liked to give interviews because I knew how important it was to speak for girls' rights, but I never liked to watch them. I don't know why. It was fine for the whole world to see me. I just didn't want to see myself. And I suppose I have to admit that I'm a lot like all those people who were so preoccupied with my appearance. I suddenly noticed all kinds of things about my looks, things that had never much bothered me before. My skin was too dark. My eyebrows were too thick. One of my eyes was smaller than the other, and I hated the little moles that dotted my cheek. A couple of days before the official school closing, my father was going to Peshawar to meet two video journalists from the New York Times, and I went with him. They had invited my father to ask if they could follow him on the last day of school, but at the end of the meeting, one of them turned to me and asked, "What would you do if there comes a day when you can't go back to your valley and school?" Because I was both stubborn and full of hope, I replied, "That will not happen." He insisted it might, and I started to weep. I think it was then that they decided to focus their documentary on me as well. The morning of our last day at school, a two-man camera crew appeared at our house. I was still sleeping when they arrived. They told my father they were there to document my day from start to finish. He was surprised. He had agreed to cameras in his school, not his home. I heard him try to talk the reporter out of this idea. Eventually, he gave in, and the filming began. "They cannot stop me. I will get my education," I told the cameraman. "If it is in home, school, or any place, this is our request to the world. Save our schools. Save our Pakistan. Save our Swad." I sounded hopeful, but in my heart, I was worried. As my father looked at me, smiling uncomfortably with a mixture of pride and sadness for his daughter, I pictured myself stuck at home, reading whatever books I could find until I ran out of books. I was 11 years old. Was my schooling really going to end now? Was I going to end up like girls who quit school to cook and clean? What I didn't know was that my words would reach many ears, some in distant parts of the world, some right in Swad, in Taliban strongholds. Later, as my friends and I passed through the school gate and the video camera recorded our every move, it felt as if we were going to a funeral. Our dreams were dying. 2/3 of the students stayed home that day, even though we'd all vowed to be there for the last day. Then one of the girls burst through the doors. Her father and brothers had forbidden her.